From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Boycotting exams is an inappropriate response to the state-mandated exam.
Standardized tests do not reform education. All they do is eliminate children from the educational process.
Today, a debate on mandatory high-stakes testing in high schools. Harvard students settle in their demand for a living wage for the university's lowest-paid workers. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a major speech yesterday, Secretary Donald Rumsfeld stopped short of advocating putting weapons in outer space, an idea that has come under sharp criticism from congressional Democrats. But Rumsfeld repeatedly sidestepped questions from reporters about whether his efforts to give space operations a higher profile in the Pentagon would inevitably lead to building anti-satellite weapons or other types of space-based military hardware. There was sharply mixed reaction on Capitol Hill to Rumsfeld's announcement, with several senior Democrats saying they would oppose any efforts by the Pentagon to militarize space. The Democratic leader, Senator Tom Daschle of South Dakota, called placing weapons in space the single dumbest thing I've heard so far in this administration. Human Rights Watch says revelations that a commando team led by ex-U.S. Senator Bob Kerry killed civilians during the Vietnam War show the need for the United States to investigate possible war crimes. Human Rights Watch said Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld should launch an inquiry to determine whether U.S. military policy, orders, and practices in Vietnam constituted or led directly to war crimes. It called for particular focus on special operations and unconventional warfare and said that if war crimes were proven in the case of Kerry's Navy SEAL mission in 1969, there should be prosecutions. The group said it had sent a letter to Rumsfeld that Kerry's revelations, quote, suggest that certain military units then operated under standing orders or employed methods that directly violated the Fourth Geneva Convention, resulting in grave breaches of that convention or war crimes. The Yugoslav president said yesterday he will facilitate and support a law to cooperate with the UN War Crimes Tribunal, which is seeking extradition of his predecessor, Slobodan Milosevic. The current Yugoslav president, Kostunica, has been vague on whether Yugoslavia will extradite Milosevic to the tribunal in The Hague, Netherlands, insisting the former president must first face charges at home. And stung by a double blow to its UN stature, U.S. diplomats past and present are trying to explain what went wrong for the United States in crucial votes last week that left them off important international panels for the first time. Although the U.S. believes it had the support going into a series of votes Thursday at the United Nations, it lost seats it has held for years on the U.N. Human Rights Commission and the International Narcotics Control Board. The House is to vote on Thursday on a bill that provides $582 million to partially repay late dues to the U.N. Angered by the vote, some lawmakers yesterday were trying to allow that payment, but to condition the final payment of $244 million on the United States rejoining the Rights Commission. President Bush will nominate 11 candidates for judgeships on federal appeals courts across the country, choosing some of the country's leading conservative lawyers, but also naming candidates the White House hopes will calm an ideological battle over the shape of the judiciary. The initial round of nominees includes a number of prominent members of the Conservative Federalist Society and former law clerks to the conservative members of the Supreme Court. Administration officials said yesterday the nominees include Jeffrey Sutton, a former law clerk to Justice Antonin Scalia, who's argued court cases in defense of school vouchers, and Michael McConnell, a leading legal scholar who has argued for an expanded role for religion in America. If you want to hear about the Federalist Society, you can go to the website www.webactive.com and listen to Democracy Now! Of April 19th. Some 700 of the world's top chief executives are gathering in Hong Kong this week for a three-day Fortune Global Forum sponsored by AOL Time Warner to ponder the business opportunities in Hong Kong and on the Chinese mainland. Former President Bill Clinton, who's attending the forum as a paid speaker, was joined by Chinese President Jiang Zemin. The forum has been marked by protests from Falun Gong practitioners protesting the banning of its members from entering Hong Kong and by pro-democracy and anti-globalization demonstrators. Hong Kong police arrested four people, anti-globalization protesters, last night. AOL Time Warner executives who remain silent on police repression of demonstrators outside the meeting are attempting to persuade the Chinese president to lift a ban on its flagship publication, Time Magazine. Two high-ranking U.S. officials arrived in South Korea today to discuss U.S. plans for missile defense, which the Seoul government fears could jeopardize ties with North Korea. South Korea was also anxious for word on when Washington will conclude a North Korea policy review and whether it will re-engage the North after suspending talks on curbing its missile program. U.S.-North Korean tension has stalled reconciliation on the divided Korean peninsula. On Monday, a group of 113 prominent South Koreans sent a letter to President Bush urging him to resume dialogue with North Korea and expressing concern about U.S. missile defense.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around, and I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down.
I Won't Back Down by Johnny Cash here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Students around the country are taking exams right now. These tests usually mean the difference between passing and failing a class, but state governments around the country are trying to institute what is called mandatory high-stakes testing. If students pass the test, they move on to the next grade or graduate. If they fail, they're held back. In New York, Education Commissioner Richard Mills and the Board of Regents have decided to make Regents exams, which students used to take only if they were seeking a prestigious Regents diploma, mandatory for graduation. Around 1,000 students and parents protested the move in Albany earlier this week. In Los Angeles, several hundred teachers, students, and parents demonstrated in front of the Los Angeles School Board yesterday. They were protesting against the Stanford 9 test, the high-stakes standardized test which is required of all public school students in California. The California State Board of Education made the test mandatory 2 years ago and also adopted a system of funding which requires schools to achieve minimum test scores in order to receive funds. California's emphasis on mandatory testing fits in with President Bush's education plan. Bush, who calls himself the education president, has called for mandatory annual tests for every student in grades 3-8. Failing schools would face penalties, enter into corrective regimes, and possibly be forced to close. We're joined right now by Ann Cook, who's co-director of the Urban Academy High School and co-chair of the New York Performance Standards Consortium. Can you tell us about your concern over standardized tests? And not everyone in the country knows what Regents tests are.
Right. Well, in New York, the testing that's the high-stakes testing that kids, students are required to take to graduate are called Regents exams. And at the present time, students have to pass two Regents exams in English and math, and they're adding global studies, American history, and science, so that students will be required to pass all five of these Regents exams in order to earn a high school diploma. That's why we call it high stakes, because a single score on any of these tests will prevent, if they fail one of those tests, they will be prevented from getting a high school diploma. Now, I think that originally the idea was that you would have higher standards than what was prevailing in the schools. Most of us, I think, are supportive. I don't know anybody who supports low standards, so we're all for high standards and higher standards. The question is, how do you measure high standards? How do you know whether you have high standards? And what the consortium, which is a group of 40 schools across the state, believes that what they're doing, what we're doing, which is to ask students to actually demonstrate what they can do, to ask them to be able to write research papers, to be able to demonstrate that they can do science experiments and apply mathematical concepts and so on, was quite a rigorous system. And 5 years ago, the former commissioner granted a group of these schools the right to have a variance to grant the Regents diploma, but to do it in a different way. And he understood that these schools were schools of excellence, and he said, well, you know, these schools are have shown that they have a good track record. The kids are going on to college. They're doing very well. And he issued a variance to allow this group of schools to use a different method to achieve the high standards, to demonstrate that we had high standards. What's changed, and the reason the consortium has come together to really protest the present policy, is that now that we have a high-stakes testing in the state, and we now have a setup where kids cannot graduate unless they pass these tests, we have gone in and asked for a continuation of our variance. We believe that you can drive reform in lots of ways, and that we have very good evidence that these schools are succeeding, and they're succeeding at a much better rate than the typical New York City school, which is using Regents, is succeeding. We have far, far lower dropout rates. Our dropout rates are below 5%. The average for the city is somewhere around 30%. Our college-going rates are up above 90%. The citywide average is 58%. So on a whole range of indicators, our students who are the same kids are doing much better by having the schools and the teachers and outside experts assess their learning. So we're fighting to maintain this variance, and the commissioner recently ruled against us. He commissioned a panel of six experts who met for 2 days, took testimony from various people in the research field who talked about the success of these schools. He heard from the schools. He heard from the parents who have chosen to send their kids to these schools. And they recommended a three-year continuation of the variance for 3 years while there was a study that they proposed to be set up to look at our students and to also look at Regent schools, a match study where we would really look at what's going on in these schools, which we were totally supportive of. And the commissioner, having spent quite a lot of money to get this group together, completely ignored their recommendations and ruled that no, beginning in 2001, September, all students who enter our schools will have to take the five Regents exams. So we have been protesting this, and had a very large rally in Albany, which is the state capital, on Monday, with about 1,500 students, teachers, and parents from across the state, not just New York City. And we'll continue to try to find a way to continue what we're doing.
Merrill Tisch is also in the studio with us. She sits on the New York State Board of Regents. Why do you feel that these Regents exams should be mandatory throughout the system?
Well, for many, many years in New York State, as Anne very well knows, we had a two-tiered system of education. We had the haves and the have-nots. Before the five Regent exam program was rolled out, there were students in low-performing schools in districts where they were truly underserved in a variety of ways who were only being exposed to Regents competency exams. We were finding very clearly, all the data clearly indicated, that these students were getting worthless diplomas that didn't allow them to have access and opportunity to lives that young adults should have as they emerge from high school and start to prepare for life outside of school. And the five Regents exams were put in place to say, we're going to stop this two-tier system, and what we're going to do is address in very specific ways what we view as the great tragedy of education, which is the huge performance gap which exists in education today. And the performance gap basically addresses the issue of some students have exposure to coursework that permits them to have access and opportunity to higher education, while other students we're getting very little. And we said everyone is going to take Regents exams. and what we are, and in that attempt, we even included special education students, because in urban settings, many, many students who are classified as special education students were being shunted into restricted educational programs that didn't address their educational needs whatsoever. So that is really the basis behind the five Regents exams. Now, let me just say, in terms of high stakes, when the new Regents exams were rolled out, people said, oh, we're dumbing down the curriculum, we're dumbing down the standards. And then I think as the first results started to come out, it was clear that the performance was about what we expected it to be as people were accommodating to new sets of exams. So all this stuff about the Regents dumbing down or component retesting, which is something I'm sure we're going to get into, which is our attempt to allow students to have as many bites at the apple to pass these Regents exams, this is not a system of dumbing down. This is a system of incorporating and including every child and, in fact, leaving no child behind.
Jane Hirschman is chair of the Parents Coalition to Stop High-Stakes Testing. What about this raising the level of the schools? You represent parents in 40 independent schools. They're public schools,
in
New York.
Right, not private. Well, we applaud the idea that the have-nots should start to have and that we need to reform education. But a standardized high-stakes test does not reform or change education. Since these exams have been instituted over the last 2 years, the dropout rate has increased 25% over what it was. For example, in the very schools that Merrill's talking about in the Bronx, one school in 96 had 1,100 students. 4 years later, it only had 121. Another school had 1,400. 4 years later, 308 are left. These exams are forcing kids to drop out because the curriculum hasn't changed. It's gotten worse. I think that the country as a whole is going towards this ideology that the way you reform education is to institute a high-stakes exam. What that does is eliminate children from that process, because if you're left back once, you're 50% likely to drop out. If you're left back twice, it's a 90% chance of dropout. And what we're seeing is that masses of kids are leaving school because the curriculum is so poor that the drill and kill and skill kind of curriculum to pass these tests forces kids to they're not thinking anymore. They're bored. They're turned off to education. And our schools are the very schools that take these children who have dropped out and who are failing, and we give them a curriculum which turns them on to thinking and learning, where they become active participants in the learning process, and they go on to college. And to think that the Board of Regents and Commissioner Mills wants to institute five high-stakes exams for the very children who are now in a system that succeeds is just ludicrous and crazy. It will change the whole culture of our schools. I also brought an example of a test question just to show you how, you know, the Regents are saying this raises the bar, this is good education. The children have a listening part of the exam where they don't get to see the questions until they've heard the passages read by the proctor. For example, in the last test, it said, in the listening part, so call me a retrograde, call me antediluvian, call me a troglodyte. This is in the passage. And then the children are given the questions later. And it says, what is the best synonym for those three words? Now, is this good education? Let's say the proctor, the teacher giving the exam, couldn't read the words. Last year, one of the passages was about the Gabor sisters. And the teachers were so young, they didn't even know who they were. They called them the Gabor sisters.
This is Ava and Jasha?
Yes.
I think I dated myself.
You did. So these exams are not quality exams. They don't really assess education, and they will never reform education.
Bill Gallegos is also with us, a member of the Coalition for Educational Justice, whose younger son just graduated from the L.A. Unified School District. We're going to break for stations to identify themselves, but I want to ask, as you listen to this conversation about high-stakes testing in New York, how you relate to it in Los Angeles. stimulus and how this fits into the national Bush administration plan for education. Our guests are Merrill Tisch, who sits on the New York State Board of Regents, Anne Cook, co-director of the Urban Academy High School, which is a public school, independent school in New York, as well as Jane Hirschman, who is chair of the Coalition to Stop High-Stakes Testing. After this, we're going to talk about the Harvard sit-in that just ended as several dozen students walked out of the Harvard president's office. Their demands had been for the lowest wage workers at Harvard University to be paid $10.25. We'll find out what happened. That's $10.25 an hour. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we talk about what's called high-stakes testing. And just to clarify, I said the schools that our guests represent in New York are independent schools. I mean alternative schools, and they're public. Jane Hirschman, chair of the Coalition to Stop High-Stakes Testing. Anne Cook, co-director of the Urban Academy High School in New York, a public school. Merrill Tisch on the New York State Board of Regents. And Bill Gallegos, who is a member of the Coalition for Educational Justice, known as CEJ. Bill Gallegos, yesterday, you protested. Where and why?
We were protesting in front of the LA school board. We had 300 parents, students, and teachers asking the school board to declare a moratorium on the Stanford 9, the high-stakes test, and the high school exit exam that's being implemented this year with ninth graders in the state of California. We're also asking the school board to inform parents to do a very wide-scale campaign in all of the languages of our district to let parents know of their right to waive their children out of the Stanford 9. And also we want the district to take an aggressive stand to stop the harassment of students and teachers who inform parents about their rights to waive out of the test or who exercise their right to waive out of the test.
Explain exactly what these tests are.
These tests are exams that are given on a yearly basis to our students. They're norm reference tests, which test students in math and English. And on the basis of the results of these tests, they have what they call an academic performance index throughout the state. And on the basis of how you do, how a school or a district does, they're allocated monies by the state of California. And even individual teachers are given money depending on how their students perform on the test. So rather than allocating money to schools based on their need, they're being given money on the basis of how they perform on these tests. And, of course, not surprisingly, the schools in the more affluent suburban areas do better. 80% of those schools qualified for this academic performance index money, and about 60% of the schools in the inner cities qualified for the money. So it just reinforces the inequality that already exists in our educational system here in California.
Bill Gallegos, I'm looking at a flyer that your organization put out, the Coalition for Educational Justice, says at the height of Stanford 9 testing, CEJ demands end the racist tests. City schools deserve better. Why do you think they're racist?
Because our school system is racist. There's an incredible inequality in our schools. In South Central Los Angeles, basic things like having ceiling tiles that don't fall on the floor, having bathrooms that work, We have a situation where one quarter of our teachers in Los Angeles are non-credentialed. They're brand new, they're inexperienced, and they're almost all, 90-some percent are in the inner city schools. We have classes that are taught year-round practically by a rotating group of substitute teachers. We lack books, we lack materials. We're 41st in, California's 41st in spending, in per pupil spending. Since 1978 in Los Angeles, for example, we've only built 10 new schools while our school enrollment has increased by 10,000 a year. So our classrooms are just way overcrowded. And that's the environment in which our students are supposed to learn. And nothing has fundamentally changed since they implemented the Stanford 9 test. That situation still applies primarily to African American, Latino, and poor Asian students. And yet now they're going to be called to account and retained even if they don't do well on these tests. We haven't lowered the class size. We haven't put in new language programs for our 300,000 students who are limited English proficient. We haven't put a computer at every desk. We haven't given them the books that they need. And yet we're going to now hold them accountable. That's the buzzword. Without changing a fundamentally unequal situation where some of our suburban school districts have all they need. They have small classes, they have the books they need, they have enriched curriculum. So we think until that situation changes, this test is inherently racist and class biased.
Jane Hirschman, chair of the New York Parents Coalition to Stop High-Stakes Testing.
Bill is absolutely right. We're seeing the same thing in New York City. They really, Merrill talked about having a two-tier system. Well, with the five Regents exams, you keep in place that two-tier system because the private independent schools, they were also told by Commissioner Mills that they had to give these exams. And they said, no, we won't.
Those are the private schools.
The private schools, the Riverdales, the Daltons, the Horace Manns. They said, and they came out with a very strong statement, saying that we do not want to change our enriched curriculum to teach to a test. And, Merrill, maybe you should speak to this because you send your children to private school, and most of the regions send their children to private school, but they're making policy for public school children that's quite inequitable. We in the consortium, our 40 schools, we want the same thing the private schools have, and we have a very enriched curriculum. We also don't want to change that curriculum to teach to a high-stakes test.
Merrill Tisch, Regent, sitting on the New York State Board of Regents.
We are very concerned about the misuse of information. And the truth is that the commissioner and the Board of Regents has been having a conversation with the independent schools as part of a consortium of the independent schools, the Catholic schools, the Jewish schools, and all the denominational schools. And the truth of the matter was that there was never any statement asking private schools to take Regents exams. It was just a conversation.
Okay.
In the middle of that conversation, the parochial schools, by and large, decided to voluntarily join into the Regents program. So we are seeing some movement. But no one from the commissioner's staff, I ever believe, made the statement that private schools were going to be forced to take Regents exams. Rather, they are just starting to have a conversation around these exams.
Well, we would like the same conversation. Matter of fact, that would be a very good thing to have
okay.
with us.
Well,
why aren't the kids who are in private, if you can buy your way into an elite system, then you can decide what exams to take. The reason the parochial schools are taking the Regents exams, because we've been in touch with them, is because they get a good deal of state money. And they have to, if they want to get that state money, they have to take the test. Whereas the independent private schools do not receive a lot of state money.
They even said at a state legislative hearing that was held last year that they felt coerced. That was the word
they
used. And I think the issue here is, what is it that drives reform? Everybody wants schools to work for kids. Everyone wants kids to be able to do better, to have more options, to have more skills when they leave school. The issue here is, what is it that helps us do that? And I think what Mills' attempt to reform schools...
Mills being the New York State Commissioner, who, by the way, was the head of education in Vermont before New York.
Right.
They had a portfolio system in place.
Well, they had a kind of portfolio system. And
portfolio
it wasn't
means
the kind of portfolio
these alternative
that
assessments
using.
That
and
they
I would say also that it wasn't in place very long before a study was done, and that the teachers in Vermont, never having done this before, and needed a lot of time to figure out how to make it work. I think that a number of our schools have had a good long time that have made it work. And I think the proof is in the data. If we're getting the same kids that are dropping out of some of these large high schools that are using Regents exams, the same kids are graduating and going on to college and doing well when they get there, surely the commissioner ought to be interested in what is it that drives that reform. And I think one of the issues here is what is it that makes teachers want to teach better, have higher expectations for kids? That's what reform is about.
I want to get those figures again, and then I'd like Merrill Tisch to respond to them, the regent from New York. The figures on when kids drop out of schools where there are regents and go into your schools, what is the, survival rate, right. But graduation rate?
Well, the dropout rate for the city for New York City is somewhere around, as it's been published, is somewhere around 30% and above.
A third of kids drop out of high school.
That drop out. Now, that's a
who enter
in
ninth
average
grade.
So that means that in some of the schools, some of the areas, the figures that Jane Hirschman was quoting at the beginning of the program, those are for particular schools in the Bronx, and the figures are much higher. So the figure of about 30% is an average. In the schools that are part of the consortium, the figure is less than 5%. The going to college rate, which for the city is 58%, for the consortium schools is up of 90%. So that means, and a lot of those kids are not going to, contrary to what some of the state officials have argued, that they are not two-year colleges. A good number of these kids go on to very well-known four-year colleges, and they do extremely well. And when they get there, they say they really know how to write, they know how to do research, they know how to be college students and survive. It seems to me those are the kinds of indicators we should be looking at. That's called predictive validity. And what we really need to be paying attention to is that one of the problems with the tests is that we have put all our eggs into this testing basket, and a lot of the issues around these tests have never been made public. For example, we don't know how they determine the cutoff score. That's never been made public. The validity studies, never been made public. The reliability studies, never been made public. And yet, we have an enormous number of kids that are going to not get high school diplomas because of these single instruments.
All right, let's get a response from Regent Merrill Tisch.
I would like to say that when the original waiver was granted to the Consortium of Portfolio Schools, I believe that the consortium was much smaller than it is now. And in this consortium, which I now I think has in the 30s someplace number of schools, there is great variety. And some of these schools are truly outstanding. And I worry right off the bat about hurting schools that are doing an excellent job educating students. So I'd like to say that right off the bat. And I would actually like to tell you that the commissioner and the rest of the board worries about that a great deal. But within the context of what we're trying to do, what we're trying to say is, and I think the study that the commissioner got says this very clearly. It says that they believe, as we believe, that these schools should be taking the English regions, they should be taking the math regions. Excuse me.
Excuse me. High stakes.
I read this report, and I'm sorry to tell you, I read it differently. So we will have to clarify that. But from my understanding, it is calling for the English regions and the math regions. The study then went on to say, for the other three regions, the data should continue to be collected. And the truth of the matter is that along the way, all of these 30-some-odd schools who are interested in doing portfolio assessment need to form a rubric that is both reliable and valid so that it can be accommodated as an alternative assessment. Part of our reform movement very clearly talks to and speaks about the importance of producing alternative assessments.
But let me just ask a quick question. Again, Regent Merrill Tisch sits on the New York State Board of Regents. You hear these figures of the average of 30% dropout rate in New York and some of the schools in places like the South Bronx, much higher than that. And you go to one of these alternative schools and you're talking about a graduation rate of more than 90%. Why fool around with that?
First of all, you need to know the students. You need to look at the data about the students entering these alternative high schools to be able to really compare apples and apples. I would like to say,
but there are kids that have dropped out.
I would like
out.
To say that
the kids
I read
who dropped out and are failing.
That's
in
not
in most
in my and I have been to the Beacon School yesterday, and we've been speaking to students and parents at a variety of these schools. I know many students who are at some of these schools because they absolutely shopped around for them. Not all of these students in these schools are there because they've dropped out. They are there because their parents or their caregivers sought an alternative. We are trying to preserve an alternative. Our policy is clearly to develop and help these schools develop reliable and valid alternative assessments. And we can agree to disagree.
What's the purpose? For the purpose of what? If 90% graduate, isn't that enough of an assessment? If 90% go on to four-year colleges, what are you talking about?
I read a study yesterday that talked about across the country, more than 80% of students who graduate high school now in the United States go on to either a four-year college or a two-year college setting. My question would be, how many of those students actually complete those colleges and their higher education? I mean, we've got to really look at it. All of these statistics, you know, one thing we should know about statistics after all these years of looking at academic statistics is I could look at a statistic, you could look at a statistic, and we can read it and interpret it in two different ways. I think what we're trying to do here is talk to a program of reform that has to do with accountability and standards for everyone.
But if you're in the private independent sector, that's a different story.
Bill Gallegos, let's bring you back into the conversation from Los Angeles, member of the Coalition for Educational Justice. Can you put this whole school movement debate into the larger economy and in the Bush administration, what Bush is calling for?
Well, you know, I mean, here in Los Angeles, we used to have four auto plants. We used to have steel plants. We used to have rubber plants. And it was really a substantial economic base for black and brown communities here. These were unionized jobs that paid well. They're gone now. And what we have now is an economy of low-wage manufacturing, service sector, garment shops, low-wage construction. And it seems like the school system is being set up so that there's going to be a small number of students who serve the needs of the high-tech industry, and a whole large majority of students who are just being taught social control and kind of factory discipline to go into these garment shops, to these hotel and restaurants, to empty the bedpans. And if that's not the case, some of our schools, I got to tell you, Amy, some of our schools are prep schools for prison. Mm-hmm. They have bars. They have no lockers. They have stop-and-frisk policies. They have zero-tolerance disciplinary policies. They have armed police.
And how do these high-stakes tests fit in?
Where are they preparing school? They're not preparing those students for Harvard. They're preparing those students for San Quentin. They're preparing those students for Chino. Our schools are becoming, in the inner cities, they're becoming prep schools either for the low-wage industry or for the prison-industrial complex. That really is, I think, what just the physical appearance of these schools now reflects how we look at our children here. They reflect the kind of priority that's given to the students here.
How did the dropout rates in New York, average third of the kids drop out, compare with dropout rates in Los Angeles?
It's very, very similar. But we have a kind of an unusual phenomenon here of what there's a group called the South Central Youth Empowered for Action. It's called the Desaparecidos. They've identified about 50 or 60,000 students in the L.A. school system who simply disappear. No one can tell you what happened to them. They just get lost in the system. And not surprisingly, most of those students seem to come from the schools in East Los Angeles, Pico Union, and South Central L.A. We have a very high dropout rate here. None of the testing programs that we've seen are aimed at changing the dropout rate. They're simply aimed at sorting out students and through retention policies or policies that push out our students, getting rid of the problem students and having a school system which continues to fail our children.
How about immigrants taking the high-stakes tests? How do
they
fare?
They have to take it in English. 300,000 of our students whose first language is not English have to take this test in English.
And the math test is very language-based, so that's also a problem. It's not just what the commissioner is saying. It's just adding and subtracting. It's very heavily laden with English problems.
Hispanic community in New York is very,
Cook,
very concerned
head of the Urban Academy.
Tests.
Yeah, we're very
again.
Concerned about what? That, and you know, especially since the state of California eliminated bilingual education here, it just adds another burden to our students.
And also, the vocational ed students—they're also dropping out in great numbers. Some high schools that are geared towards learning disabled students are closing up. We won't have to worry about resources for schools. We'll have to build prisons. That's where the resources will have to go.
Last comment to Regent Merrill Tisch.
If we want to talk about systemic reform and we want to particularly focus on those English language learners, one of the things that I think we've got to realize in this state and probably across the country is that high school is no longer a four-year proposition. To get these kids accommodated to the language, to get them prepared to really graduate high school with the resources, the personal resources that they're going to need to succeed, I think that we've got to absolutely review high school and thinking of it more as a 5 or 6 year process than a 4 year program.
If people want to get in touch with the different groups in Los Angeles, the Coalition for Educational Justice, where can they call Bill Gallegos?
They can call area code 213-389-418, or they can call area
That's 213-359-389-3418.
389-3418.
And Ann Cook, co-director of the Urban Academy High School?
If people want to get in touch with the consortium or performance assessment, they can call 212-570-5394.
That's 212-570-5394. I don't know, Regent Merrill Tisch, if you have a number.
My office number is 212-879-9414, and you can email me at MerrillT@yahoo.com.
And all that information will be on our website at webactive.com, and you can also hear this conversation. I want to thank you all for being with us. Jane Hirschman, chair of the Parents Coalition that deals with high-stakes testing, and Cook, co-director of the Urban Academy High School, Bill Gallegos with the Coalition for Educational Justice in Los Angeles. And by the way, we did call the office of Roy Romer, the superintendent of the L.A. Unified School District, but they declined to come on. Also, yes, Jane Hirschman?
I can give a number out. If parents are listening and they want to get in touch with our coalition that's building across the state, my number is 212-222-6721.
I want to thank you all for being with us. And when we come back, speaking of someone's mention of Harvard, yes, the students have walked out of the president's office, which they occupied for 3 weeks, demanding a living wage for the university's lowest paid workers. We'll find out what happens. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, 26 Harvard students emerged yesterday from the office of the president after a 19-day sit-in to demand that Harvard University provide a living wage to its lowest-paid workers. The Harvard Living Wage Campaign was perhaps the most visible example of recent community-based efforts to demand that universities, city governments, and other institutions pay their workers a living wage. The students reached an agreement with the administration to create a 20-member committee composed of students, faculty, workers, and school officials to make recommendations on the university's wage and employment policies. The university also agreed to stop outsourcing custodial and janitorial work until the committee makes its recommendations and pledged early renegotiation of custodial workers' contracts. Students working both inside and outside The sit-in mobilized support from city officials in Boston, labor and civil rights organizations around the country, and hundreds of Harvard University faculty, alumni, and students groups. The students argue the wage and employment policies at Harvard, which has a $20 billion endowment, increasingly resemble those of a large corporation, with the outsourcing of low-wage work, the use of temporary employees, and fierce resistance to efforts to raise workers' standard of living. The campaign also highlights what the students say is the increasing corporatization of Harvard in particular and higher education across the country. Let's start with Ben McKean. He's a Harvard College junior majoring in social studies, who was inside during that occupation. Welcome to Democracy Now, Ben.
Good morning. Thank you.
Do you feel like you accomplished what you wanted to?
I feel that we had a pretty terrific victory yesterday. Harvard is known for being intransigent in these sorts of situations, and we made the move. The creation of this committee will have professors face-to-face with workers who are actually receiving the poverty wages that we've been protesting, and I think that's a tremendous achievement. I think that for Harvard to agree to back pay for these custodians is incredible, and the moratorium on outsourcing will make a big difference. Outsourcing, of course, is the primary way that the university has cut wages and benefits for most of its service sector employees.
I'm looking at the latest issue of The Nation magazine, and you did a piece in it called Harvard Shame, where you talk about the members of the Harvard Corporation, the university's highest governing board. Who are they?
Well, there are seven members. The first is President Rudenstein. He is one of only two members on the Harvard Corporation with any sort of background in education. More representative would be someone like the university treasurer, D. Ronald Daniel, who is also a partner at McKinsey, and in a variety of other enormous multinational corporations. We've also got people like James Houghton from upstate New York, whose family owns Corning. His brother is the richest member of Congress. We have people like Herbert Whitaker, who's on the board of Enron, Bob Stone, who is on the board of several energy companies, including the Kirby Corporation, and who is also the Commodore of the New York Yacht Club. It's difficult to believe how much these people represent that elite, but they are, and so it's no surprise that they would pay poverty wages.
Robert Stone, also chair of the search committee that selected the next president of Harvard, who will be coming in July, Lawrence Summers.
That's right, yes.
Who comes from the World Bank and most recently Secretary of Treasury. Well, as you listen to this, let's go to our second guest. Who's with us, Lawrence Soley, wrote a book called Leasing the Ivory Tower about the corporate takeover of academia. How does that fit into your thesis?
Well, at almost every university that you look at across the country, whether it be a private institution, whether it be a public institution, whether it be an elite, or whether it be a sort of run-of-the-mill institution, the boards of regents or the boards of trustees tend to be dominated by the business leaders in the areas where the colleges are. I'm at Marquette University in Milwaukee, and probably the most influential person on the board of trustees at my university is James Keyes, who's the head of Johnson Controls, one of the largest companies in the Milwaukee area. You tend to find that everywhere, but increasingly you tend to find the chief executives of universities, that is, university presidents, coming in from the private sector. I mean, you mentioned Lawrence Summers and his ties as former Secretary of the Treasury and World Bank. This is not unknown. This is fairly typical today. Of course, the level to which they were in government depends on how elite the institution is. For example, you mentioned Summers being the former Secretary of the Treasury. Well, Michigan State University hired Pete McPherson as their president. I'm a MSU alum. He was the former Deputy Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration and a former Bank of America executive.
Also interesting, just a quick comment for regular listeners of Democracy Now! We were talking about MSU, Michigan State University, a few weeks ago because they had an undercover cop, that's a university cop, infiltrate the anti-corporate globalization groups on campus. And the next thing they knew, they saw her in uniform on campus.
deja vu, because that's what was happening there back in the late 1960s and the 1970s. But even back then, the executives were, by and large, coming from academia, but the heads of the boards of regents and boards of trustees tended to come from corporate ladders. So that's one of the major changes we've seen in probably the last 15 years, is where university presidents are coming from. The days of the teacher-scholar ascending to the presidency of a university are by and large gone. I mean, we tend to see people like Senator Boren, former Senator Boren, becoming the heads of universities like he did at the University of Oklahoma. So that's been a major change in the last 15 years or so.
What do you think are the social costs of corporate ties?
Well, they're immense. One of the things that's been happening that was mentioned is outsourcing. This isn't just happening at Harvard University. This has happened at universities across the country. A Marriott corporation has moved in, and today they tend to run the food facilities at universities across the country, along with one or two other companies. Same things happened at bookstores. So they have removed the lowest-cost workers from universities.
One point there, it's not just Marriott. It's Sodexo Marriott, which is owned by Sodexo Alliance, the French multinational company that's the major stockholder in CCA, Corrections Corporation America, which runs the for-profit prison system here.
Right, and they also run the facilities at most airports across the country. I mean, it's a huge company. And we have seen increasingly monies being diverted from the public sector to the private sector, with universities serving as the conduit for that. Let me give you an example of that using Harvard, since that's the sort of focus of the day. Back in the 1990s, Harvard University's Dana-Farber Institute signed a 10-year, $100 million deal with Sandoz that gave Sandoz the rights to any research findings obtained by professors who had obtained funding from Sandoz for any project.
That's a pharmaceutical company.
And as a result of this, Sandoz had access to research findings that were funded by the federal government. Now, at the time, federal funding for research at Harvard amounted to about $350 million annually. It's way past that. So what we're talking about is Sandoz getting access over a 10-year period to probably $5 billion in research that's being financed by the federal government. And what happens today is that universities sign these exclusivity agreements with pharmaceutical companies and other manufacturers that give them the rights to findings that were obtained with federal tax dollars. So what we find is companies going in, providing a small amount of money to universities and walking off with a large amount of money that's been funded by the federal government. And because they have these exclusivity agreements, that explains why prices for a lot of pharmaceutical goods are so high. I mean, we taxpayers pay for the research that's done, and yet companies walk off with these exclusive licensing agreements that allow them to sell them at monopoly prices.
I want to bring Jen Kern into this conversation, who's the director of ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, ACORN's Living Wage Resource Center in Washington, D.C. Jen, going back to the issue of the living wage at Harvard that Ben McKean and others led a three-week sit-in for the lowest-paid workers at Harvard University, how does that living wage campaign fit in around the country to other such campaigns?
Well, the Harvard campaign is the most exciting recent chapter in a larger national living wage movement, and it responds directly to the same trends in corporate America that are creating this increasingly hostile climate for workers both on campus and in the low-wage labor market more generally. So the national living wage movement of community organizations like ACORN, labor unions, faith groups has succeeded in the past, since 1994, in passing living wage laws in over 60 cities, counties, and even school boards nationwide. And like the students who use their leverage as tuition payers to reject poverty pay on campus, these campaigns are going to their city councils, their county commissions, and saying where tax dollars are benefiting private companies like large service contractors who work for the city or folks that get economic development money from the city in the form of a tax break, for instance, that those employees, employers should pay their workers at least a living wage with health benefits and, you know, other standards like corporate accountability, local hiring. So that's going on in about 75 cities and counties right now.
Do the issues raised at Harvard reflect those being raised by other campuses?
Yes, and they're the ones that you've mentioned already, the ridiculously low value of the minimum wage, this trend towards contracting out. Many of our cities are doing the same things that the universities are doing. They're, you know, contracting out to have the grass cut, you know, in the city park by a low-wage contractor that's paying, you know, their workers just barely above minimum wage, in food service and security and temporary and clerical workers that do work for the city. Those are the same kinds of trends that we're seeing in campuses and in cities.
Ben McKean, a Harvard College junior, sat in for almost 3 weeks at the college president's office. You compare what the low-wage workers get at Harvard to MIT. It's something around $12 an hour, I believe, at MIT. But you still didn't get the university guaranteeing that they would pay the $10.25 you were arguing for. Is that right?
That is true, although I think that this committee has a strong possibility of arriving at that conclusion. I think that...
What was the university's argument for not paying workers $10?
Well, that's been my favorite part of the past 3 weeks, which is that they haven't had one. Their argument I've been involved with this campaign for about 3 years, and I've never heard an argument against the living wage from the administration. I've only heard them say no. And now I figured this would be a good way to get a more full explanation out of them, but... unfortunately, all they did was tell us the sit-in was an inappropriate tactic.
How did the larger community react to that strategy of occupying the president's office?
People were incredibly supportive. I had never expected the kind of support that we ended up getting. We had thousands of students come out. The workers were obviously incredibly supportive. We even had support from people like... Senator Ted Kennedy and Senator John Kerry, who both came by. I'm sure that it's not every day that senators come by a student building occupation, and I think that it just goes to show what a modest and reasonable demand $10.25 an hour is, especially for the Cambridge area.
You have Bob Haynes, the president of the Massachusetts AFL-CIO, quoted in today's New York Times about the Harvard sit-in, saying, "You're the moral conscience of the university. I hope my kids grow up to be just like you."
That's sort of embarrassing.
Will you be able to remain at Harvard? What are the consequences for the sit-in?
Well, I think we all went into the sit-in knowing that disciplinary action was likely. I think that given the level of community support, it would be politically disastrous for the university to do anything too harsh.
Is it true that some professors taught their classes right outside the president's office so you guys could hang outside the window and be a part of your class?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I did two of my classes that way for 3 weeks.
How many professors supported what you did?
More than 400 signed a letter and then took out a full-page ad in the Boston Globe urging the university to enact a living wage policy and also supporting the sit-in tactic. So we're very confident about the level of support there.
Jen Kern, if people want to get information on ACORN's Living Wage Resource Center, where can they go on the web?
ACORN.org.
And Ben McKean, the website for the Harvard University Students Protest?
LivingWageNow.com.
And Larry Soley's book is Leasing the Ivory Tower, the Corporate Takeover of Academia. I want to thank you all for being with us as we wrap up the program. If you'd like to write to us, you can send us mail at mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. That's mail at democracynow.org. And you can get a cassette of today's program in our archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at war crimes with Chris Hitchens and others. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Matthew Finch is sitting in for Anthony Sloan, and Errol Maitland's our technical director. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!